In the Ring with Eusebius Makaiser. Eusebius
Makaiser. One of the most popular episodes in the Ring with Eusebius Makaiser thus far has been the frequently asked questions about COVID-19 that I did with medical doctor and scientist Professor Francois Venter from Wits University. So I thought I'd bring him back because you have written to me with many more questions that you have. And of course, the pandemic is going nowhere. So this is round two of FAQs about COVID-19. Francois, thank you so much for coming back on amidst your very busy schedule.
Hi, everybody.
The questions are going to be fairly random. We'll go for about 15 minutes or so. And that should be another act of public duty on your part that you do so well. Question one, why does the virus come and go in waves? It's a question I was thinking of in the bathroom this morning to overshare. Why does it not permanently affect us exponentially? Why does it give us breaks every now and then?
So it's a great question. And we have absolutely, not no idea, but very little idea. In South Africa, when I look at it, each wave has been associated with a different variant. The politicians or the public health people and lots of other people have blamed it on human behaviors. So the second wave was blamed on matric rage parties, but actually the wave was predated that by 2 weeks. The third wave, you know, was very firmly the Delta variant that everyone's aware of, and no specific human behavior. It's not that human behavior don't modify it, but it's not, the waves seem to my eye took very variant dependent, which is interesting, because if that's the case, if it's variants that are driving the South African waves, we need a new variant to take, you know, to sort of drive it, to drive a fourth wave, for instance. And we haven't seen any signs of any new variants since April last year, which is when the Delta one declared itself. So with a little bit of luck, you know, most South Africans have either had COVID or been vaccinated. We're largely immune to any of the new variants coming along or to the current variants that are circulating. So we just don't know what's going to happen around a fourth wave, if it's just going to be a minor surge, whether it's going to circulate. We also don't know, you know, it's been very, people said it was seasonal, but it's not really seasonal. It's just every 6 months. It's no specific temperature or thing that seems to be following that. The other coronavirus is circulating, give you a cold and sniffles, you know, every so often on a sort of seasonal basis. But this is not the way this one's behaving. So I think the short answer is we don't know at the moment, and we're just kind of eyeing December and Christmas time with a BDI.
I got the first jab of Pfizer. A couple of days later, I had COVID-19. As you know, I obviously survived that. People who want to hear about the experience and lessons learned can go onto the podcast platform and go and find that episode. I Nearly Died from COVID-19 is the title of it. Can you explain to the public why Eusebius was infected and ended up in hospital after one jab a couple of days later? Because many people think if they get the jab, they should not go to hospital or even be infected.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a couple of weeks for the immunity to build. In fact, probably from about 10 days onwards, your immune system starts building up. It takes a couple of weeks for it to fully come on board. In the case of the Pfizer vaccine, you need the second jab to get full immunity. You know, the first one gives you pretty good immunity up to about 60-70%, but the second one takes you well into the 90s. What happened to you is what we see with flu, when the flu epidemic happens, you have people, you know, you have a terrible surge around you. People think, oh, I better get my vaccine. And in fact, it was just too late. They just didn't have time to build up the immunity. And what happened to you is you were exposed, by the sounds of it, to listening to your podcast, perhaps even within the actual facility itself, while you were being vaccinated. So you just didn't have time to actually get it, to get the immune benefits of the vaccine. It's part of the tragedy of South Africa is that, you know, our vaccination program was so delayed that by the time we were firmly into the third wave, very few people were protected. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's okay. I'm going to shelve the question I had in mind because what you've just said prompts an important couple of follow-up questions. How long is immunity for? Does it get weaker and weaker over time after I have been fully vaccinated?
So it's another, you know, it's a really one of those things scientists are grappling with at the moment. And there are two things the vaccine does. It stops you from going to hospital and dying. And it also stops you from becoming infected. Now, what we know is that we've got very good data out in the last few weeks that the immunity from getting a vaccination or from getting COVID, in your case, is highly protective against the hospitalization and death, even 18 months in the case of COVID and 1 year after the vaccine, which is how long we know we've got data from. So if you've had a vaccine and you've had COVID, you're highly protected against the bad things happening. What we do know, though, is both of those, the immunity against getting the virus, just simply getting a sore throat and feeling a bit snotty, and in some cases getting much sicker than that, just being a day or two in bed, does wane with time. And this is what people are talking about with the boosters and all the other stuff that you're hearing about. So those two components, the stuff that keeps, makes me sleep well at night, is the fact that I'm not at risk for, the severe horribleness of being in hospital and ventilators. But I do know that I'm going to get infected sooner or later, simply because that kind of absolute sterilizing immunity that makes me bulletproof from infection actually does wane.
If I had COVID-19, I was lucky enough to survive, and I'm listening to this podcast. Is it a waste of time to go and get the jab because my body, having survived, built up natural immunity? And I've read some articles that suggest that natural immunity is even better than getting the jab.
So we don't know if there's benefit to getting the jab. I mean, I would just get the jab simply because, we're going to this idea of passports and, entrance to restaurants and things. I think this is going to be with us, and workplaces is going to be with us for quite some time. So just on a practical level, I think getting the vaccine probably just to make your way through society, even if you've had COVID, is good news, is something to be done. We don't know if getting the vaccine is, you need the vaccine if you've had COVID. We know that you have a lot of immunity once you've had COVID. A lot of people do say to me, like, getting COVID gives you better immunity than the vaccine. That's actually not true. I think conceptually it's useful to think of getting COVID as having had the vaccine, essentially, because it does give you a similar level of protection. But when you look at the immunological responses, when you get COVID, you're exposed to all chunks of the virus. So you get a very broad immunological response. While if you get a vaccine, it's a very narrow immunological response. But that doesn't mean one is better than the other. In fact, if you get very broad immunological responses, sometimes it can be a bad thing, because one can slightly squash the other one. Mm-hmm. While we're being very straight and narrow and laser like can mean that your immune response is very focused on taking out the virus. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't spend too much time, a lot of people come to me and say, oh, should I get the virus rather than the vaccine? It's like, the answer is absolutely no, because like you can end up hell of a sick. But even if you do survive, your immune system is pretty much trained now to look out for the virus and take it out. But it doesn't mean the immunity is better or worse than that from a vaccine.
My cousin, who is not vaccinated, said to me the other day that she's now finally decided she's going to go vaccinate. She went to a place in PE and she didn't get vaccinated. I asked her why not. And she said, quote, they didn't have the Johnson one. They only had the Pfizer one, Eusebius. And I've heard that the Pfizer one is the one that kills people. You're a doctor and a scientist. How do you respond to my cousin?
So both the J&J and the Pfizer vaccine have very, very rare side effects that can be very serious. So, the fact there are deaths associated, but, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people being vaccinated to see one death. While with COVID, you need just a couple to see one death. So the response is, don't worry about Pfizer and J&J. I always use I think I used on your previous show, the analogy of having two luxury German cars and seeing which one has the bigger cup holder. It really is, that level of detail. They're both brilliant vaccines. They stop you going to hospital. They stop you dying. One might be slightly better than the other in some ways and not in others, that we haven't quite determined yet. But honestly, at this level of detail, I would say to your cousin, just get the first one that you can. The nice thing about the J&J is it's a single jab. The Pfizer is two jabs, which is slightly more inconvenient, but they both work like a bomb.
If everyone is fully vaccinated and 3 weeks passed since we all got our second jab, can I have a massive bride in my house?
So as long as everyone's vaccinated or has had COVID together, yes, is the short answer, I think. I mean, a lot of my colleagues are very, very risk averse. But increasingly, we think that if people are vaccinated, firstly, we know that they're not going to, the chance of getting sick if they do get infected is very small. We also know they're less transmissible. But we have a future in our coming to us where we can actually get rid of the masks, where we can keep an eye on surges. And if you know, there's a new variant, all bets off. But a normal society again, where we can start congregating together. The reason at the moment that we are careful is to actually protect the unvaccinated and the people who aren't eligible for vaccinations, who might be harmed by the fact that we aren't taking care of others. And that's... would be in this our case is children. You know, we know that children are much less likely to get ill, but they're not eligible for vaccination, so they're just not protected. So if you have a kid who you're exposed to, might have early leukemia, for instance, who, you know, we just don't know, the kid isn't sick yet, and you give that child COVID and that child's immune system is compromised, you might kill that child simply because, you know, you've taken your mask off and said, oh, everything's back to normal. Until we've got all the information in front of us, which will be soon, I think in the next 6 months, I would suggest that if you're exposed to unvaccinated people, you're quite careful. But once you're mingling with vaccinated people, as long as they're not taking the virus home to unvaccinated children, you can start behaving pretty much normally.
If I'm fully vaccinated and I don't care about the unvaccinated, because in my mind they're irresponsible anyway, so I don't care about protecting them, why is it important for my health to still be wearing a mask in public?
So it's becoming steadily less important, but in the same way that you just don't want to get flu. You know, like I said, once you're vaccinated, the chance of you being hospitalized is, it's not zero, but it's close to zero. And I certainly do know a few people who've been very sick. But in the same way that you've been vaccinated against flu and somebody with flu is in front of you coughing in your face, you know, you don't want to spend 2 days in bed. You don't want an unnecessary viral infection. So that would be the reason. We are getting to the stage, though, where you need to start questioning wearing masks, you know, everywhere, you know, in very close, you know, if you're in a lift with a whole lot of people, you're coughing, yeah, that probably is a good idea. But honestly, walking through a well-ventilated mall, you know, going out, especially if you're outdoors, I really don't think that that's necessary anymore. I know that is government legislation at the moment, but it's increased. I mean, even at the start of the epidemic, there was questionable whether we ever needed masks outdoors. Okay. But increasingly, if you're vaccinated, you can return back to your normal life.
I, following advice from credible scientists like yourself, have always mouthed as part of the non-pharmaceutical interventions something like the following: and also don't forget to wash your hands regularly with soap, and only if you don't have soap, use a good sanitizer with at least 70% alcohol. This is a purely academic question, but of interest to some of us who are nerdish about these things. Is sanitizer with 70% alcohol as good as soap, or is soap marginally preferable out of interest? And if so, why? What's so special about soap compared to sanitizer?
So soap is actually much more effective at killing viruses than sanitizer. It breaks down the cell wall much more efficiently. And any old soap, you know, you don't even need special soap. There's a very funny article written about, you know, so, you know, the good smelling soap versus the bad smelling soap. It doesn't matter. The way it works is it breaks down the oils in the same way, you know, like sunlight does in my when I'm washing the dishes. It just breaks down the cell wall within a few seconds, and it's much more effective than sanitizer. Sanitizer, alcohol sort of tackles the, kills the virus, but it's not nearly as effective as soap and water. The interesting thing, though, that you do raise is that we're still not totally certain that this virus is transmitted off surfaces. So this whole drama with sanitizing and, you know, wiping down surfaces and things, it's probably good for other viruses, but we're still not totally certain that it makes much, if any, impact on the coronavirus. So I'm hoping that we didn't waste everyone's time and panic with all this like sanitizer that we're wasting at the moment. But we do know that the respiratory transmission is by far and away the most important one, which is where the masks and the indoor congregation is more important.
We're getting to the end of the frequently asked questions installment two. But I want to ask one more research science question before I get back to the more regular questions that folks have written me about to put to you. Again, for those of us of a non-scientific bent, myself included, I'm always thinking, like, if you know that soap can kill this virus and I'm put at ease once I've washed my hands, isn't the clue to be found in why the soap is so effective? Like, do you guys research soap to try and understand how better to fight viruses?
So, I mean, it's A lot of the research actually had been done around soap and just the kind of impact on the cell wall. There's a whole field of infectious diseases, which traditionally people found incredibly boring, around how sanitizing and how things, infections are controlled and stuff. I think all the people involved in that field are feeling very smug at the moment, because now they're sort of being validated by the fact that their field seems incredibly important.
Hygiene matters and is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is that probably this hand washing stuff has had a massive impact on other viruses, and probably is what we should have been doing. So, it's not that sanitizing and hand washing, all the other stuff. I think as children, we were all told hand washing was important, and kind of let it fade a little bit as we went into adulthood. But there is lots of evidence that, going into the future, this kind of getting on planes and insisting on washing your hands and wearing masks and things will probably have some impact on, just the normal colds and sniffles and flu that we have circulating. So the coronavirus, for all the devastations, has had this important knock-on effect on public health, where we're going to take a step back, I think, and look at all these kind of basic hygiene measures and actually the benefit they might have.
Professor Venter, a last question around treatment. Since you and I last spoke, given the impressive rapidity of research in real time, what do we know thus far about treatment, and what kind of questions are the right questions you want your patients to ask you after you've told them that they've got COVID-19? For example, I keep hearing about something called prednisone. Must I say to my doctor, prescribe me prednisone? Blood thinners, doctor. No, I don't want ivermectin. Where are we at with treatment?
So it's useful to think about, firstly, just get the vaccine, because it stops you even having to worry about all these discussions. But it's good to think about this virus in three ways. There's the kind of first way, where it gets to the back of your throat and starts colonizing your throat like all viruses do, and give you a sore throat and a bit of a sniffle. Then there is the invasion phase, which is the scary one, which is where it gets into your bloodstream and it sees the organs and it causes this massive inflammatory reaction. Mm-hmm. Then your body clears the virus. But in some of us, including probably happened to you, the inflammatory wave is actually uncontrolled or partially controlled and causes lots of damage. And that's what puts you in the hospital. In fact, most people end up in the hospital have probably cleared the virus. So what you do is you try and stop them at each point. The hospitalization stage, we've got really good therapies, and you were the one exposed to them. That includes drugs that are similar to prednisone. We use blood thinners. There are all sorts of things we're using at the moment. And we're getting much better at treating severe people, including how to use oxygen and all the rest of it. What's exciting is the second stage is where the virus, you're getting a sore throat, it's about to invade. And there's a whole generation of drugs that are coming through the mix at the moment. They're still under evaluation, and then we still need to see what exactly they're doing and what the side effects and stuff are. But they're starting to declare themselves, and there's one from a drug company called Merck that's just last week being described. We haven't seen the full data set, so I'm a bit skeptical. I just need to see it properly before I come out and say anything. But essentially what that's stopping is the invasion stage. So when you were feeling really sick suddenly and you realized you had something really ghastly happening and that you were feeling man down, that's where a couple of tablets for 5 days might be an antiviral that we take that stops you from getting to the hospitalization stage. Or instead of spending 7 days in bed, you spend only 2 days in bed. So these drugs are on their way. For the few people who actually do get significantly ill, who have a breakthrough infection on the vaccine. So it's a very exciting therapeutic time at the moment, and there's a lot of effort going at it. As I said, people must be skeptical about these things, because drug companies are making a fortune out of us from this, but that doesn't mean that the drugs themselves aren't a good thing. In terms of ivermectin, everyone's very excited about it still, for reasons I have absolutely no idea about. Unfortunately, ivermectin is probably going to go down in medical history as one of the most shameful research debacles ever. The five biggest studies which we used to drive the sort of pro-ivermectin group, unfortunately, have all been found to be grossly fraudulent. People were cutting and pasting data points in Excel spreadsheets, and there's a whole investigation going on around that. So the bottom line is, just don't use ivermectin for anything until we've got better data to support its use.
Oh, can we put in a bonus question? Remember, we always used to try and make you awkward on radio for your colleagues to laugh. Can we talk about sex quickly?
Oh, always. I'm an HIV doctor. I'm always thrilled if we can get back to sex.
So Francho Fenter, for those of you who may not know, which is unlikely because I know you know him, is, of course, one of the world's best HIV clinicians, and an important conversation we have over and over again as part of public education in my various platforms that I've occupied is if you are undetectable in terms of your HIV load, the viral load in your body, if you're HIV positive, then you can't transmit even if you have unprotected sex. Obviously, other sexually transmitted infections are possible, so you've got to be careful. And also, you know, you don't want to fall pregnant unless you are gay and you can't, like me, if you're having sex with another man. And I have been very curious, especially before we all got jabbed, as it were, no pun intended, whether if you're going to have a one-night stand during the pandemic. I've always thought, like, theoretically, I wonder which is more unsafe, not knowing the HIV status of the person that I'm having a one-night stand with, or whether or not they are actually fully vaccinated. If I'm fully vaccinated, how safe am I? And if I'm going to be, you know, getting someone over from Grindr, is it awkward or is it useful for me to ask them, are you vaccinated, Francho?
So again, I think the good way to know, it's a great, I hadn't thought about it like this, I'm mulling over the several like different scenarios and things. Again, I think the danger is to the unvaccinated person. I mean, you don't want to get flu if you're, you know, even if you had the flu vaccine. And the same goes for the COVID thing. Is I don't particularly want to get COVID at the moment. I don't feel like spending a couple of days in bed. A lot of my staff got COVID, even though they were vaccinated. Mm. About 20% of them had to take days off work. So it's still a vicious little virus. Having said that, if my partner I'm inviting from Grindr across is unvaccinated and I've got, you know, sort of low-grade COVID and I might transmit it to them, you know, having sex with somebody is a very intimate act. You probably are going to transmit it in that moment. So I think it's worth, in the same way as discussing your status in the HIV scenario, it's probably worth discussing vaccination status. But again, people, you know, like I think with sex, need to take a certain level of responsibility with it as well, as to say, I'm going to disclose as much as I'm, you know, as I should. That's the responsible thing to do. But there's a limit to what I can expect from my partner. You know, as long as I give them all the information to keep them as safe as they can, I expect the same from them. But, you know, life does need to carry on. And you can't simply, yeah, we can't have a society where we can't have sex. So this is the future that we're looking at. Is probably saying, is have you had COVID or have you had the vaccine? Because if you haven't, I have, and I'm safe. You know, I would like to keep you safe.
Yeah, or do a rapid test downstairs before we go to the bedroom.
That's, I mean, increasingly that is going to be an option. The problem with that is it's a bit like, you know, is it's not perfect. It gives you a sense, and it's a pretty good sense, but it's not absolutely perfect.
Francho Fenter, thank you for sharing your knowledge as always, and in such a simple way without compromising on the integrity of the academic quality of the work. Thanks for coming on the platform.
No, thanks everyone, and thank you, Eusebius, for doing all that you do.